Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Lamed Chet Amud Bet by the two dots. The Gemara is asking a very basic question, which is, Heichidami Micha, how does one go about objecting to the individual who's trying to establish a chazaka in the property which he believes belongs to him? So Amar of Zvid, Planya Gazlanahu, Lohavi Micha. He gives you the negative formulation, which is that, I'll tell you what doesn't work, if you say so-and-so is a thief. So as the Rashbam notes over here, all you're doing over there is discrediting the individual. You are casting aspersions about the character of the individual. You're not addressing the particular instance or issue that's at hand. If you call someone a gazlan, that doesn't mean anything about the fact that they're in your property. They might be a gazlan and be in your property rightfully. So just calling him a gazlan in and of itself is not sufficient to create an objection over here. On the other hand, Planya Gazlana, who nakit la la arai bigazlanuta, so-and-so is a thief, and he's in my property as a thief, ulamachar tavanale bedina, and tomorrow or the next day I'm going to bring him to court to extract the property from him. That, havya mecha'a, that's the type of objection you need. So what's clear here is that Planya Gazlana doesn't work. Of the next two statements that the Gemara adds in the final expression that calls a mecha'a, there's a question as to whether you need both statements or only one of the two statements. I mean, is it enough for him to say, so-and-so is a gazlan, and he's in my property unlawfully? Would that suffice in order to generate a mecha'a? Or do you also need, do I also need that additional statement that I'm going to bring him to court over this manner? Palanya gazlanahu, the ka'achila la arai, because he is eating from my, which in of themselves seemingly should address all the issues, which is, you're no longer speaking to his character, you're speaking to the specific instance, and saying that he stole my property. And that should be a mecha'a, because that's exactly what we want to clarify over here. Does this individual have rights to this property? Does he not have rights to this property? You just declared he has no rights to this property. So what is ulamachar tavana lebedina? On the opposing side, you have those that say, if you wanted to say that you need all three statements over here, then the Gemara should have said in the first place, you know what doesn't work? Planya gazlanahu doesn't work. And neither does planya gazlanahu, the nakalul arei gazlanuta. That also doesn't work, because you still need the third statement in order to make this into a mecha'a. So you can see in the Rashbam, Rashbam over here quotes two views as to whether this is necessary. If you look at the top of Lamed Tet Amud Aleph, Ilo Amar L'Machloni Gazlan D'Kachil Arab Gazlanutu Bilvad, Hari Hu Kenotein Pagam B'Chaveiro, V'Lo Kimusiri Dut V'Eino Mecha'a. That's not considered to be a Mecha'a. Tein Perish Rabbeinu Chananel. Rabbeinu Chananel requires all three statements in order to be a Mecha'a. Then he says, Lashon Achrina Shamati Mishmu'at Rabbi Yaakov Bar Yakar, one of Rashi's Rebbeim, V'Ikar Planya Gazlanahu, V'Afilu Yizkir Al Karka Zeh Shemachzik Lav Michai, Shelo Micha Machmat Atzmo. Aval, Im Perush Kacha L'Arayv Gazanuta, Hari Micha Machmat Atzmo. There you have now directed the claim from himself. If you're casting aspersions about his character, that certainly doesn't work. But once you connect it to your property, then you're making a clear statement about what your objection is. And Vavir Mecha. Va'afagav lo siyem the machar tavana lebedina. Even if you don't end off with this terminology that I'm going to bring him to court tomorrow. So the reasons on both sides, one side says, look, if you say that you do need this third statement, then why did the Gemara bring as an example of a failed Mecha'a, the statement that Ploni Gazlana Toho, and the Nakad La'arai B'Gazlanuta, that should have been a failed Mecha'a. How come the Gemara only gives the example of Planya Gazlanuta? On the other hand, for those that say that you don't need the third statement at all, then why did the Gemara bring it? What was the meaning of that last statement? So you have Rishonim lining up on both sides. One of the reasons that you might need the third statement is brought by the Rabbeinu Gershom. Aval ki amarlu l'machar et v'ne bedina havya mecha d'kamarlu d'ein da'ato limcho. That the statement I'm going to take him to court means that my objection is not simply an objection, it's an objection where I'm going to enforce my legal rights. You could object, or you could say someone's a thief, but then do nothing about it, or just let it go. You could be mochel on it. So therefore, the third statement is what defines it as a statement of objection, which you're going to take legal action about. And that makes it into a real objection. Others frame it in the following manner, which is, you are making a statement about the gazlanuta. The question is, are you just joking? Are you just making a point? You're not going to enforce it, or the person doesn't really believe you because you don't say you're going to make it or take legal action about it. So whether he thinks that you're mukhel on it, whether he thinks that you're not serious about it, that last statement that I'm going to court over it makes it or gives it that wrapping that it's a really serious statement, that I'm not just joking around. For others, the fact that you've directed allegations against him is sufficient grounds for him to have to retain a shtar and be careful that there are people out there that are objecting to your possession of the property. The first statement of Ploni Gazlano, there the Gemara rejected it as a mechanism for a mecha'a, either because of what Rav Yaakov Bar Yakar said, which is just directed in general, it's not about your property in particular, or the other one is that it's not warning him to watch his shtar. So if you just speak about the person, then either you're not directing it to the particular land, or you're not warning him sufficiently that he should keep his shtar, because it has nothing to do with his shtar. This has to do with him as an individual, what you think of him as an individual. The next statement, the Bach, compresses the two statements. It doesn't say that he says, Ploni pl gazlanahu, but rather the way the Bach writes it is, Ploni gazlanahu de ka'achil arai. He's a thief, he's taking my property. Not that there are two statements. He is a thief, and he's taking my property in theft. But rather, he makes it into one statement that he is a thief because he's in my property improperly. So that would solve some of your problem, which is not making a separate statement about him. He's directing the fact that he's a thief is because he's in my property inappropriately. But your question's fair then if he takes it in two steps, so-and-so is a thief, and he's in my property by theft, then it seems to be unnecessary or excessive. I think the Gemara is just building on what they said before doesn't work. So then they come along and tell you, well, even if you say that, but if as long as you add on this additional information, then you can make it work, or the machal works in that case. It might be that the Gemara is trying to show you that even when you still direct or level the allegations against him, as long as you connect it afterwards to the property, that makes it a sufficient micha'a. Because you could have thought that it's a distraction, the statement that he is a thief, and you're just bringing evidence that that is still a statement about him and not about your property. So the Gemara is saying that even with that, as long as you've directed it towards the property, and the Korni Samri Shonim also mentioned that you're going to court, that would be sufficient grounds for a mecha. So here, the Gemara asks, how does a mecha work when you do it shelo b'fanav? As the Rashbam says, when you do it not in front of him, when you're trying to articulate your objection, how do you articulate your objection when you're not doing it face-to-face so that you're indicating to others your displeasure with what is going on? And that is what we just discussed here. Then, if the person raises such an objection in the following manner, the question is, does it work as a mecha'a? Amar lo timrule. He tells the people who he's disclosing this information to, don't tell him about this. My, what is the din in that case? So he speaks in front of Edim, we'll see how many individuals he needs to say this in front of, but he articulates the fact that this person is a thief, he stole my property, I'm going to take him to court. But, you know, do me a favor, don't tell him that. So now, is that considered a mecha'a? The whole point of the objection, seemingly, is to get it to the ears of the individual who's on the property, so that he keeps his shtar. Rav Amar Rav Zvid, Hakamar lo timrulek. What's the question? He told him not to tell them. That's not called a mecha'a anymore. A mecha'a is when you direct the information to reach the individual who needs to hear it. Over here, where you specifically stipulated don't convey that information to him, that's already no longer a mecha'a, because if you really wanted to object, you would have made sure that the information got to him. Rav Papa Amar, L'didei, lo temrulei, l'achrinu imruluhu. Chavrach, chavra yitle, and chavra de chavrach, chavra yitle. The same statement that we've seen all along in the Gemara, that once the word gets out, it will eventually reach the ears of those that need to hear it, because of this rumor mill, or the way that news travels. It will be ensured to get there as long as it's spread. As long as you keep telling it over, you tell it over to other people, it will end up reaching the individual who is being makzik in the property now. So Rav Papa says, we will infer from his statement, or implicit in his statement is the following. You don't tell him, but you may tell others about it. So what he's saying is, I don't want you to be the direct bearers of the news to him, but I want it to reach him indirectly. So, don't tell him what I just told you, But go ahead and spread the word. Get the word out. And then it'll eventually trickle down to him. Now, the Rishbam here says, Hachi Kamar. When Rav Papa says it, this is what he means. You can read that in one or two ways. Hachi Kamar, this is what he said. He says, don't tell him, but tell others. Or Hachi Kamar means that we implicitly assume that's what he meant. When he said, don't tell it to this particular individual. He just doesn't want it going directly. But he's implicitly telling you to direct it to others and spread the word. Amrulay, if the individuals with whom he shared this information, they tell him, Lo Amrinanlay, we did not tell him. You disclosed this information to us, but we never told the person who's trying to be makzik in your property about it. What do we do with that information? Now, the Rishbam points out over here, and it makes sense, that this is not a cumulative question. It's not a case where the individual first said, don't tell him, and then the Edim come back and said, we didn't tell them, because Rav Zvid already stated his opinion. When you tell him not to say it, it's no good. So then this wouldn't even be a question for Rav Zvid. What he's saying is, this is a totally independent case. In a case where he didn't say anything to the Edim, but the Edim come back to him and disclose to him that they never conveyed the information to the person who was trying to be makzik in the property. What do I do with that? Amar Rav Zvid, hakamrulei lo amrinanlei. They are telling him that we never told him. That's enough to believe that there is no mechah here. There was no objection because it never reached the individual who needed to hear it. Rav Papa Amar, lididei lo amrinanlei. We did not disclose the information to the machzik. Lachrinu amri lahu. Once again, we'll infer from their statement, or whether they're stating this explicitly, that we didn't tell him, but we told others about the information. Is that sufficient? Chabrach, chabra itle. V'chabra de chabrach, chabra itle. Once again, we're invoking this principle that if you get the news disseminated, then it will end up in the right place or reach the ears that need to hear it. So in that case, or seemingly over here, the machlok between Rav Zvid and Rav Papa is whether the macha'a has to reach the individual. Rav Zvid, over and over again, seems to indicate that the objection must reach the individual who it's intended for, because the whole point of the mecha'a, seemingly according to Rav Zvid, is to ensure that this person keeps his shtar. The only way for him to do that is if he gets disclosure of the information. So even though we permit mecha'a shelo bifanav, even though we permit you to object not face-to-face with him, we still want that objection to reach the party, and in the most direct manner possible, so that when you disclose the information to those individuals, we're going to assume those individuals will go to this person and disclose the information to him. Which is one second. On the other hand, Rav Papa has a looser definition, which is Rav Papa says that you don't have to get it directly to the individual. As long as the news is disseminated, either we'll say anansade, or we'll say that in all likelihood, this type of information will reach the individual. And that's sufficient grounds to be considered an objection. And what the Balei Tosafot point out about that is that Rav Papa does not necessarily disagree with Shmuel. Remember yesterday we had Machloket Rav and Shmuel as to whether when you speak to people who cannot convey the information, you're speaking to individuals who are chigrim, zkenim, people who they themselves will never convey the information to the party that needs it. Rav said it's still a good mechah. Shmuel said that doesn't work. So now Rav Papa seemingly is subscribing to Rav's position, which is you don't need the people who you are objecting in front of to convey the information directly. But the Balei Tosafot point out is that Rav Papa could even subscribe to Shmuel's position, because he believes that if you disclose the information to these individuals who have the potential to eventually get it to the person that your objection is directed towards, that's enough. Even though they themselves don't do it, as long as they are people that could do it, that's sufficient. But he would agree with Shmuel if he told it to people or conveyed it to people who can't do it themselves at all, that that wouldn't work. Even though he's invoking the principle that Rav uses in order to say that information disseminated is important, he still needs or still requires a minimum threshold that the people who hear it could have conveyed it to the individual. If they don't, that's fine. But they at least could have done it. In their way, the Balei Tosafot reconcile Rav Papa with Shmuel's position. Because otherwise it would seem that Rav Zvid and Rav Papa are arguing in the same machloka that Rav and Shmuel had yesterday, which is, do you need direct conveyance of the information, or at least a potential direct conveyance of the information, or is it enough that you just get the information out there? Right, but the assumption is, that's what the Rishbam said yesterday, anan zadeh. Once the information is disseminated, we assume that it's going to get to him. The same way that the chazakah reached the individual who wanted to be mocheh, so too the mecha'ah will reach the person who needs to hear about it. I mean, that's our assumption here. We're trying to create a situation which isn't burdensome on both parties, which is that we want the person who is there in the property to be able to become the muchzak in the land in a reasonable way, but we also want someone who is the true owner of the property to have a way to stop that from happening and to retain his chazakah in the property, his ownership in the property. So we have to do it in a way that's not too burdensome to the party who wants to object, but another way that gives rights to the individual who is in the property. So that balancing act is leading to these differences in opinion or assumptions about what it takes to object, as well as to what is the rights of the individual who's there to establish his chazakah. And so there's a balance between those two competing interests, and that's what Rav Zvi and Rav Papa are arguing about. What's enough of an objection so that the person's rights don't get abrogated because someone's on his land? So do we insist that he runs all the way over there and says it to him in person? That's a big burden of proof on that individual. It means that if he's far away, if he's traveling, all of a sudden he's going to be under this obligation to return, to object, or send shlichim. Whereas if we say that it's just informational, then we give him a leeway in dealing with the situation that's reasonable. I think that's what the discussion is. So now, amar lo, lo tipik luchul shuta. Don't say a word. The word shuta actually appears at the end of the Gemara in Sukkah. It's actually a famous Gemara. Gemara there speaks about an incident that took place in the Beit HaMikdash. And the Gemara says that not only did they penalize the individual who said something, they penalized her family, and then penalized her Beit Av within the Kohanim. Her whole greater family she came from, they punished them. And the Gemara says, why would you do that? This is a person that chose to do something improper. We could penalize them. Why are we penalizing other people as well? So when it says, shuta dininoka, the words or the expressions or the conversation of youngsters, of children, they heard in their house. They either heard it from their mother or they heard it from their father. Children, when they speak, reflect what they experience in their house. I mean, today the experiences are much greater than that because there are foreign elements that also enter into the child's mind, whether that's in the school or whether that's with their friends or that's with the media. So there are other influences that give them the opportunity to express things that maybe they didn't hear in the house. But in their day, you lived in a very small world. And therefore, when a child spoke and said something, even though we've never heard it from the parents, usually the child learned that or developed these ideas because they heard something similar from the parents. There the Gemara says, shuta de yinoka. The conversation or the expressions, articulation of the child is reflective of their mother and father. So here he says, lo tibik luchu shuta. Don't say a word. Don't make a peep. Amar azvid, hakamar, lo tibik luchu shuta. There's nothing to discuss over here because he said to them, don't say a word. In that case, you can't expect the information to reach the other party. Not directly and not indirectly. Given that, you haven't objected. Objecting in private is not an objection. And that's what you've done here. You basically said the information or conveyed the information to two people. And then that's it. You want it to stay with those two people. That will not work over here. And you see here, there is no argument of Rav Papa. So Rav Papa would agree in this case that there's no way for the information to be disseminated if he told them in particular not to convey the information. Amrulay. Lo mafkinan shuta. So the next case is not where he told them not to say a peep, but rather where they tell him that we never told anyone. You disclosed the information for us, and since then we've kept it private. We've never disclosed this information. Am Rav Papa, hakamri le lo mafkinan shuta. Here again, Rav Papa agrees to Rav Zvid's position, which is, they're telling us information which says that we never conveyed the information. That means it remained in private hands. It never got to the party that needed to have it, and it's not considered to be a micha. Rav Huna b'rei de Yeshua amar. The other hand, Rav Huna b'rei Yeshua says, "Komilta d'lorami alei de'inish amar lav alav adate." Any piece of information where an individual is not particularly instructed to keep it private, they don't think about it, and sometimes they just say it in conversation without taking notice or without remembering it. Since there was never an instruction given to you to keep it private, then you don't think about keeping it private. And sometimes you'll disclose the information later on and say, I never told anybody, I never said it to anybody, because you don't even think when you do say it or convey it to other people, because there was never an instruction to do otherwise. If someone tells you to keep it private, don't tell anyone, and then you tell it to them, you remember that you told them because you did something against the instructions of the party who disclosed the information to you. And then where he never made any demands of you, and then you go and disclose the information, you don't think about it. You don't consider that it's because nobody told you otherwise. And so what Rav Huna Breid of Yeshua says is their declaration that they never told anybody, we can't rely on that. In essence, they probably did tell people, they just don't remember telling those individuals, and thereby the information is considered disseminated, according to Rav Huna Breid of Yeshua. And the Rishbam over here suggests, it's a case, she'enu mutalat alav livarer, or there's an alternate girsa over here, that she'enu mutalat alav liksuya, that it wasn't a demand placed on him either to clarify the information or to keep the information private. Begamenu mafsid. You have no loss from this information. Imomerim lo amra. Whether you tell it or you don't tell it, it has no financial impact on you. Amar lo bnei adam v'lavadate. Then people just spill those beans or speak about it in casual conversation without considering it or without thinking about it. So then he says, v'hilchata. The halacha is ben amar amimache lo temru le mide mehani mile the machzik. Whether the individual said don't say it, it works. Ben amru lo mafkinan shuta bikulu avya micha. He says that across the board we consider all of these to be a micha bar midamar lehu amimache lo tebikluchu shuta, with the exception of the case where he specifically instructs them not to say a word, not to anybody. So he says over here that the halacha follows all the opinions that are makil here, with the one exception of the case where Rav Zvid says, if he told him not to say a peep, then he didn't say a peep, and then nobody disagrees with that, because then there's no way to have them disseminate the information unless they do something illegal or improper, which is to disclose information that they were told not to disclose. So in that case, it will not be considered a micha'a. All right. Now the Gemara says, Amarav Nachman, micha'a shelo bifanav, havya micha'a. So now we have a statement which says that when a person objects, not in front of the party who they are trying to object towards, that is considered to be a micha'a. So now you have a statement of Rav Amarav Nachman, and then Eitve Rav Adar Rav Nachman. It's a very difficult reading in the Gemara, because here the statement is a statement of Rav Amar Rav Nachman. So the whole statement is Rava conveying information that Rav Nachman said. Then all of a sudden you have Eitve Rava the Rav Nachman, Rava queried Rav Nachman. Well, why is Rava querying Rav Nachman if the only reason we have the memra from Rav Nachman is because Rava is the one who brought the information to light over here, or he's the one that's conveying the information. So it doesn't make so much sense. Over here the Rashbam speaks about the style of the Gemara. He says, "V'afagav d'otvei Rav Rav Nachman, shita ta Gemara hi b'harbei mikamot kein." The Gemara does something like this in many places. V'achi perusho, ki shama Rava mi Rav Nachman hach milto. When Rava heard this statement from Rav Nachman, then Amar Rav Nachman eitvei achtu yuvto. He asked him this question. Rav Ashi shesidera Gemara hu deka amar. He is the one who said, Amar Rava, Amar Rav Nachman. It wasn't that Rava conveyed the information to us. It wasn't that Rava ever said this over the name of Rav Nachman. Rav Ashi is telling us that Rava said this in the name of Rav Nachman, and at that time he queried the following. So what the Rashbam is pointing out is that many times when the Gemara is telling us information, this is important to know that it is the Misadriya Gemara, Rav Ashi, and the other later Amuraim, it is their version of what transpired. Sometimes it never transpired. Sometimes you'll have conversations between Amoraim that probably never happened. But the Gemara, in presenting the information, presents that it is as if there is a machloket between them, which there is, but then as if they were speaking to each other, going back and forth about their proofs. Did they ever have that conversation? Maybe, maybe not. But the Masada Gemara presents the information in a manner or a didactic manner which allows you to learn from the conveyance of the information in that manner. And similarly over here, Amar Rava, Amar Rav Nachman is not a statement that Rava made, but rather Rav Ashi indicating to us that Rava heard this from Rav Nachman, and in hearing it from Rav Nachman, he queried Rav Nachman the following manner, which is, Eid Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Yehuda, he brings from our Mishnah, Lo Amru Shloshanim, El Kadei Shehei Basfamya, the reason we have the 3 years is so that if he's in Spain, V'yakzik Shana, and then the chazokah is established in the first year. Then it'll take a year to get that information to the individual in Spain. And then he'll return in the following year. So there you see that the individual has to bifanav, he has to come back. Now the Baal Tosafot yesterday said, how do you know? Could just mean that he has to show up locally to have the information disseminated. You know, all you have to say now is that he has to come back because in Spain we will not assume that the information reaches the individual in Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, if he comes back to Eretz Yisrael and then does a mecha'ah there, he doesn't necessarily mean he has to do it face to face. Just must mean that he has to do it closer to home than further away. There's necessarily a proof. So Tosafot yesterday, and Tosafot today also says something of a similar nature, says that that can't be the explanation. Because if that is the explanation, then the Chachamim's position also will not be understandable. The beginning of yesterday's daf, after the Mishnah, the Gemara concluded with regards to the Chachamim's position, whether Mechash Shibifanav or Shilobifanav, which way are the Chachamim or the Tanakhama going? The Gemara said it must be that they believe that it is Shilobifanav, that it's not in front of him, and the issue was the issue of Shat Chirum in Yehuda B'Galil. But he says, if what I'm saying is true, you couldn't prove anything. Because you'll never know based on the fact that you either demand that he comes and stands in front of him or doesn't stand in front of him, because all you're saying is he's got to be local. Well, if he's just got to be local, then we can't prove anything about the Chachamim's position either. We have no idea what they are arguing about then. The Tosafot points out, the fact that the Gemara assumed that that was their position, it shows you that when we say you present yourself locally, that means in person. When we say you don't have to present yourself locally, that means not in person. And therefore, over here too, Rabbi Yehuda, when he says to show up, he means show up and declare the information. Why does he have to move? Let him do the mecha'ah or object there in Spain. And just like the information reached him from Eretz Yisrael to there to tell him that someone's on his property, in reverse, it will happen back. He'll send the information back in the same manner. Now, there's a very basic problem with Rava's question. And that is that he's just asking from Rabbi Yehuda. Why doesn't he say that the Chachamim are a proof to the position of Rav Nachman? Okay, so Rabbi Yehuda, you're right. You have to show up in person and convey the information. So that's a question, Rav Nachman. But the Chachamim in the Reisha, who say that you don't have to come back, who say that 3 years are about keeping your shtar, they say that you could do Mechash Lo B'Fanav and it would work. So why doesn't Rava bring that as a proof to Rav Nachman rather than Rabbi Yehuda as a disproof to Rav Nachman? So some suggest, the Ritva says this, is that he did not qualify his statement. Rav Nachman never said, I'm saying this in the position of the Chachamim. He just made a statement as if all Tanaim would agree with this. So Rav is pointing out that Rav Yehuda's position would not accord with what you're saying. The Baal Tosafot, on the other hand, say that Rav has a totally different reading of our Mishnah. Baal Tosafot say, why didn't he bring a proof from the Rabbanan? Vomari, the Rav hayat to'eh. Rav had a misunderstanding about our Mishnah. He says that there is this equation of equivalence which we saw yesterday in the Rashbam. But the Rashbam keeps this to the conclusion. The Rashbam himself says that if information can travel from an individual to the party to know about the fact that there's a chazaka, in reverse, the mechah works in the exact same manner and the information will reverse back. And that is the position of the Rishbam. The Rishbam says that the information flows equally in both directions. The Baal Tosafot made it clear over and over again yesterday that they thought that the information from a chazaka travels much faster and easier than the information from a mecha. We saw the Baal Tosafot themselves say that the person whose land it is looks into his land. He checks up on it. The person who's machzik in the land doesn't look for the mecha. Other Rishonim, we brought their way to express it, which is someone taking someone else's land is a public issue. People know that the guy's stealing or sitting on the other person's land. That's information that will get disseminated. A mecha'ah, there's no reason to disseminate it. We said whether land doesn't move, but with an objection, a person can move to convey the information. There were many reasons as to why to differentiate. What the Baal Tosafot say is Rava made a mistake and assumed that the information was bidirectional and moves at the same pace bidirectionally. And therefore, the machloket in the Mishnah between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim is simply, where is that threshold of information flow? Where does it stop? Rabbi Yehuda says it can reach all the way to Spain. On the other hand, the Chachamim say that the cutoff is between Yehuda and Galil. So they're just arguing about where the perimeter of information flow is. But they don't disagree about, this according to Rava, is that if the information can flow out about the fact that the person has established a chazaka here, it will flow back just equally in Mecha. Once you've done that, that means that the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda's position is about the perimeter or where that threshold is, not about whether you have to get the information back. Now, Rabbi Yehuda's statement that you must come back in person in the third year, that statement should affect both positions. Meaning that should be equally true of the Chachamim as it is of Rabbi Yehuda. And therefore, the conveyance of the information back has to be done in person, and that question would be a question both from Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim based on that. That's how the Balei Tosafot phrase it. On the other hand, the Rashbam says something interesting over here. He says, "Taima de Rabbi Yehuda, la mishum tlat shnin mizdari yishne b'shtare." Rashbam says over here, like he said on the Mishnah, that Rabbi Yehuda's position is not reliant on the 3 years that a person keeps his shtar, but rather the amount of time it takes you to travel that distance. "B'taima de chazaka de lidei mishum delo shavikin ish da'achle arei below reshuto." Nobody lets their land be eaten without permission. Meaning that no matter where you are, what you are, if you see it and you allow it to go by, the person establishes a chazakah. Because we have a belief that as soon as you hear about it, you must object. Otherwise, you're acquiescing to his possession of your property. Nobody lets someone else sit in their house, be on their field without permission, unless they really do own it. So therefore, you have to object. Rabbi Yehuda's position derives from the fact that you're in Spain. The 3 years is just the amount of time, or the maximum amount of time we gave for that information to travel and reach you out there. Yeah, that's why the Rashbam said it on the Mishnah. I mentioned to you in the Mishnah that there were other Rishonim that disagreed and said that even Rabbi Yehuda would agree you need a year. Because you see in the case of the Mishnah, he says the chazakah lasted a year, then they conveyed the information. So it seems that the information or the chazakah was only established after a year. So you could argue on that small point of the Rashbam as to whether it's immediate or after a year, but it's not about 3 years in keeping your shtar. And then he says, then what's Rava thinking over here? Because if that is the case, and remember the Rashbam believes that information flows freely in both directions. That means that according to Rabbi Yehuda, if you demand that you come in person to object, then the same thing would be true by the chazakah. And that's what he points out over here. Alma. An objection not in person is not called a mecha. Remember, the Rashbam always sees the two as working in tandem. That means that if you cannot do a mecha unless you do it in person, that means you can also not establish a chazakah unless the person's actually present there and sees you on the field. Well, if that's the case, then being out in Spain doesn't really matter because he's not in front of him. So they're never going to have a chazakah like that. So what he points out is that if Rabbi Yehuda really believes that you have to come in person and object, that means that you're never going to establish a chazakah when the guy is away because of the fact that he is so far away and you're not doing it in front of him. Given that, so I've come to Rabbi Yehuda, I'll be chazakah b'halchi. Nevertheless, we know from the Mishnah it's clear that Rabbi Yehuda believes you do establish a chazakah when you're out in Spain and the information is conveyed to you that you can establish a chazakah. But then he says, Udarova, so what he says is that Rova doesn't hold of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda, it requires him to come in person and be me'arer. Rova believes the reason that you can't establish a chazakah here is because of the fact that since you can't object, you can't establish a chazakah. Remember that if you're unable to object because of whatever variable, that same failure to object then is no longer an indication that we acquiesce to your ownership of the property. So what he points out is that Rava is using Rabbi Yehuda, even though Rabbi Yehuda himself would not be able to say what Rava is saying here. And so that Rava is excerpting from Rabbi Yehuda one piece of information, even though that one piece of information that would make the whole case impossible. Which is that if you believe that you need to do mecha b'fanav, that means that a chazakah could also not be established bifanav, and that means that the whole case in the Mishnah wouldn't exist. So what's clear is that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't think that. But Rava says, no. Break Rabbi Yehuda up into two pieces. He requires you to object in person, but the chazakah you could establish without being in front of him. I don't hold like Rabbi Yehuda. Failure of the chazakah over here is only because he can't object. Since he can't object, you can't establish a chazakah. So that's how the Rashbam deals with it, but the Rashbam is really premised on his belief that chazakah and mecha are always equal. The way that Tosafot stated it is that was Rava's mistake that he thought that. The way that the Rashbam says that that's the way you have to believe, and that would be the position of Rava and Yehuda, is disagreeing with that, what is considered to be the norm or the default. But now, what does Rav Nachman say back to him? He's giving him good advice, Rav Nachman says. Denetu v'nishkol aro pere. Come back and get your land back as well as the perot. What you see from here is that the reason to come back is not because you require mechafaf enough, but it's not a halachic reason, it's a practical reason. It's if you don't show up, the way the Rashbam expresses it over here, is that once the stuff is gone, it's very hard to retrieve. Meaning that once a person eats gazelle, you can't get it back. If you preempt him and you stop him from taking the item, then you have much better chance of getting your money back. Others express it just the longer you wait, the more you're going to have to try to get back, and the entrenched situation is going to be harder and harder for you to undo. So that for that reason, he's just giving you good advice. Come now and take care of the issue, because if you let it linger, it's going to be a worse situation for you. Now, Gemara says, Midakam motiv le rova le Rav Nachman. The fact that Rova queried of Rav Nachman, Michval de lo svirle, it sounds from like that he does not subscribe to the position, Michal shalo pavanav, avi michal. Basically, Rova is disagreeing with his Rebbe, Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says, Michal shalo pavanav works. Rova says, are you sure it works? I have a question from you and from the Mishnah. So from there, it sounds like Rova does not believe that that is the case. Vahama Rova, didn't Rova tell us, Michal shalo pavanav, have your michal? Don't we have a memra from Rova that says that a michal that is not face-to-face still works, that objection works? So now we have a stira seemingly in Rava's position. He's querying his Rebbe, challenging his Rebbe's position, yet he himself seems to subscribe to that position. That's the girsa that we have. You can see the Tosafot had a different girsa. Hachi Garcina, Michlau de lo svirle ha amar Rava michal shelo pavanav. He says that, didn't Rava say, it's not that Rava amar Rav Nachman. When it says v'amar Rava, it's Rava saying it, but it's not Rava saying it in the name of Rav Nachman. That goes back to the problem with the start of the sugya, which is Rava was saying it in the name of Rav Nachman. So obviously, if Rava is saying it in the name of Rav Nachman, it's not an issue, because then he's quoting his Rebbe. So that doesn't mean he subscribes to it. The Gemara is saying, "Vamar Rava." Rava himself said, "Michal shelo pifanav is a mecha'a." When he said on yesterday's daf, "V'hilchata mecha'a shelo pifanav havia mecha'a." So once Rava himself states it, that seems like he agrees with his Rebbe, Rav Nachman. So then, why is he challenging his Rebbe? So Gemara says, "Bolted the Shamim Rav Nachman Savra." At first, he disagreed with his Rebbe, but then when his Rebbe stated it that Mechash Lobanav is a good Mecha, Rava then agreed with that position after Rav Nachman explained to him how to read the Mishnah with Rabbi Yehuda. So once Rav Nachman answered his question, Rava accepted it and then came to the same conclusion as Rav Nachman, which is Mechash Lobanav Havi Mecha. Ashkechino Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina and the Tamidav de Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina finds the Tamidim Rabbi Yochanan. I'm like, oh, mi amar Rabbi Yochanan mecha bikama. Rabbi Yochanan, did he ever address the issue when we're talking about a mecha shelo b'fanav? Did he ever address the issue as to in front of how many people do you need to make this objection? So here is a question which belies any mecha shelo b'fanav: is what is the purpose of the mecha shelo b'fanav? Again, if it's a purpose of dissemination of information, maybe we require you to convey the information to more people in order that there's a higher likelihood that the information will get to the party. Or is it simply that you need to make a declaration, you need to object, and as long as you've done your objection, it's clear that you've objected, then that's sufficient grounds for blocking his chazakah. It's not that the information needs to be disseminated or to reach him. Depending on how you view the objection, would also color what you think or the number of people that the objection needs to be done in front of. Rebchia bar Abba and Rabbi Yochanan. So Rebchia bar Abba in the name of Rabbi Yochanan says, Micha'a bifnei shnayim. To do it in front of two. Rabbi Yochanan, Micha'a bifnei shlosha. That you have to do it in front of three. So now, the Gemara here does not say this, although Yerushalmi does mention it, that you could have easily just said that two and three is the difference between a dim and a beit din. That's what the Gemara does in other places. Two is the minimum number for Edim. Three is the minimum number of Beit Din. And so the argument here could simply be whether the Micha objection has to be done in front of Edim, or does it have to be done in front of a Beit Din. Our Gemara never entertains that possibility, but just without even starting down the Gemara, whenever you hear two and three, those are the associations that you would normally have. The Gemara says, Lema b'derabba b'ravuna kamiflige. Let us say they're arguing within the position of Rabba b'ravuna. This is a Gemara in Arachin. It says, any piece of information that's conveyed in front of three people, is not considered to be lashon hara. Man damar bifnei shnayim, the one who says that you do it in front of two, lately the Rabbi Bar Avuna. He does not subscribe to that position of Rabbi Bar Avuna. Man damar bifnei gimel, the one who says you acquire three, itle the Rabbi Bar Avuna. They do subscribe to the position of Rabbi Bar Avuna. Over here, there's a major machloket in the Rishonim as to what the meaning of this Gemara is. There are two main tracks, and then they subdivide afterwards. The two main tracks are, is this issue of Lashon Hara integral to the case? And what we're speaking about here literally are laws of Lashon Hara. Or is Lashon Hara just a siman? It's just an indication, which is that we can learn something from Lashon Hara, although our case has nothing to do with Lashon Hara. It's a reference for dissemination of information. It's a siman to indicate to you what's classified as disseminating of information, but it has nothing to do with our case in terms of Lashon Hara. So you can see in the Balei HaTosafot, as well as in the Rabbeinu Gershom, the Rabbeinu Gershom over here says, Kol milta shel ganai, anything that is detrimental that is said, dit amra b'apei tlato, that is said in front of three people, and those people go and convey the information to others. That is not considered to be Lashon Hara. So what the Rabbeinu Gershom is saying is that once the information has been conveyed to three parties, those three people going and repeating the information are not subject to the rules of Lashon Hara. And that's why it's permissible for them to convey the information. That's how he's reading the Gemara over here. The one who says that you say it over to two parties, and those two parties will convey the information. They do not subscribe to this position of Rabba Bar Avuna, because they believe even with two, there's no longer a din of Lashon Hara. Whereas the one who says you need three subscribes to this position of Rabba Bar Avuna, and therefore once he is objected in front of three, those three can be comfortable disseminating the information, because they're not going to be in violation of Lashon Hara. Our fear is here that the people he conveys the information to will not convey it forward because they're speaking in a detrimental, derogatory manner about this individual, and therefore they're not going to convey the information. What we're saying is you got the all clear, because three people, once three people know about it, there's no Lashon Hara by conveying it forward. So it's clear here that the Rabbeinu Gershom sees an integral connection between Lashon Hara and our case. The question is, when you do a mecha'ah, when you object, you are, in a sense, speaking Lashon Hara. So then, how do I overcome that problem? Well, you do your micha, because for you, it's necessary, otherwise you're going to lose your land. For the people who are now conveying it forward, it's not a problem, because you told it to three people. Once three people know about it, it's no longer Lashon Hara to convey it forward. So you're overcoming the problem of Lashon Hara, or possibly Rechilut, which is the spreading or disseminating of information that is negative. So now, the Balei HaTosafot, on the other hand, take a different approach. Again, within the world of Lashon Hara, which they say, Leipa Mishum Lashna Bisha, Dekala Ida, V'sofo She'eda. It is information now that is public, and in the end it will become known. So Tosfot explains in the second Tosfot that when he tells it over to three people, it's not Lashon Hara, because that person is not worried about it reaching the individual about whom the information was said. So Tosfot says, why is it not Lashon Hara over here? Because it depends on the intent of the speaker up front. If the speaker of Lashon Hara wants the information to reach that party, and he would have said it in front of that person, face to face, he'd have no problem saying it to him. Then when he says it to other parties, it's not called Lashon Hara, because he's not trying to hide the information. He's simply trying to convey the information to this party, speak to this party. He's not here. So he tells others because he wants those others to convey the information to him. And therefore, it's not called Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is when you say something detrimental about another party, but you don't want it to reach him. You're doing it for your own benefit. You're doing it in a manner that is to degrade the other individual, but without speaking to that individual. When you speak to that individual, you wouldn't say that. You'd cover it up. You will be polite and flatter the individual. Never say anything of the sort. So in that case, that's called Lashon Hara. For the Tosfot, it's amazing. We don't pass an halacha like this, but for the Tosfot, Lashon Hara is only when you speak to others about a third party, and you would never say that to that person, and you want to hide it from that person, because you're trying to take down their stature without ever speaking to them directly, or having it come out of your mouth, or be heard from you towards that person. If you were to go right up to that person and say the information, then when you tell it to others, it's not called Lashon Hara. That's the way the Baal Yetzer Tosfot learned over here, that the conveyance to three people makes it clear that you don't care about the other person hearing about it, because you've made it public. You made it public, you can assume that he's going to hear about it, and your assumption about him hearing about it means that you also would have said it to him directly. So both the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Baal Yetzer Tosfot believe that the problem is Lashon Hara here. They're integrally connected. And how do you overcome the problem of Lashon Hara? For the Baal Yetzer Tosfot is once you tell three, according to the other party, once you tell two, it makes us believe that you would say it to the party in person. Once you do that, there's no Lashon Hara, and the information can be conveyed forward. The other end for the Rabbeinu Gershom, once you've made it public, the people who then convey the information onward are not in violation of Lashon Hara. It has nothing to do with you speaking Lashon Hara, and you would say it to the other party. It means once it's in the public realm, then these people conveying the information forward are not doing anything wrong. Now, the Rabbeinu Yonah explains or tries to explain why it is that this would not be classified as Lashon Hara, either when it's already publicly known or where you would want it to get to the other party. Why is that not considered to be Lashon Hara? So the one answer is because we're assuming it's L'Toelet. The reason you would convey this information directly to the other party is because you want to help that party out. So when you convey it to others, you're doing it in a manner that's also the toelet, because you want it to reach him so that he changes his ways or he does something different. Another way to formulate it is, the problem with Lashon Hara is when you make a statement that is interpreted to be negative. But if you make a statement that can be interpreted negatively or positively, we will give you the benefit of the doubt when you go public with it, that it's the positive side. Otherwise, why would you go public with it? That's what he quotes in the name of his Rebbeim. And then he does also brings a third way, which is that the person is stubborn, is unwilling to listen to you or to allow you to convey the information to them. Therefore, you're using a indirect manner to get the information to him. So for all those reasons, the Rabbeinu Yonah tries to justify why this would not be Lashon Hara. But underlying all of these opinions is that the reason the Gemara is bringing Lashon Hara here is to teach you that this is not Lashon Hara. The other hand, the Rishbam quotes this and rejects it out hand. He says, "V'lav milti." He says, there is no Lashon Hara over here. "D'lo domi l'Lashon Hara klal." This has nothing to do with Lashon Hara. "D'ikar mecha'a haino mishum d'binan sh'yavoa d'var lo'oznav shel ha'magzik u'mitzvah hi lomar." The whole reason for the mecha'a is to get to the party who is being magzik in the property so that he saves his shtar. And therefore it's a mitzvah to tell him. "Mitzvah hi lomar l'kadesh yizar b'shtaro." If the information doesn't reach him, then he'll never keep his shtar and he'll be hurt by it. So Lashon Hara is not Lashon Hara when it's the toelet, when it's to the benefit of the party who's receiving the information. These people should convey the information, not worry about Lashon Hara, because it's not Lashon Hara. For that, they are doing a favor to this party if they tell him. If they don't tell him, he's not going to keep his shtar. If they tell him, he'll keep his shtar. They're actually helping him by disseminating the information. That's not called Lashon Hara. And so what the Rashbam says is, this sugya has nothing to do with Lashon Hara. There is no Lashon Hara here at all. So why did the Gemara bring this din of Lashon Hara here? It's a siman to indicate to you what is considered to be dissemination of public information. If you believe by Lashon Hara, telling three people makes it already public, and that means that these three people can convey it or say it without any qualms because it's already in the public realm, that shows you that telling three people is the equivalent of disseminating the information publicly. And that's what we learn from there. We're learning what is considered to be public dissemination. Not that this is Lashon Hara, it's just a way or a siman to indicate what is the rules of disseminating information. And that's the way the Rashbam learns over here, that this has nothing to do with Lashon Hara. Baal Yetzer Tosfot just raised one interesting issue, which is that if you borrow money baal peh, we say that you're not allowed to go after encumbered property. If you borrow money with a shtar, you have a right to go after encumbered property. The Gemara over there says, because borrowing with a shtar has a kala, is something that becomes public. And therefore, the people who are buying are informed and warned that there is a person with a lien on this property. Now then, a loan, baal peh, is not something that is public. What happens if the person lends money orally in front of edim, in front of two or three, like over here? Why isn't that considered to be public dissemination of the information? He should be able to go after encumbered property. If you're telling me that three people make a public dissemination of information, then that din should be true by a loan baal peh. So Tosfot answers, like he's answered before, that you have to differentiate in the dissemination of public information. A person who borrows money is not interested in the dissemination of the information. He usually wants to keep it private or quiet. In that instance, just having edim there is not a reason that it will get disseminated. You have to have two factors there. You have to have information that we want disseminated, plus you have to have the mechanism in place that will allow the dissemination. Those two things are, one, you need at least a minimum of two or three, whatever the requirement is. And number two is you have to want the information to get disseminated. In this case, we want the mechah to be disseminated. It's to the advantage of all parties to have the mechah go public. Therefore, when they hear it, we assume it's going to get publicized. In a case where a borrower has no incentive to have this information go public, then in all likelihood, even if there are the requisite number of parties, it's not going to go public because he has no interest in seeing it go public. So that's the difference. Tosfos says you need those two factors to have it become public. Mar says, look, the kuli alma itlu the Rabba bar Rav Huna. Everybody subscribes to this position of Rabba bar Rav Huna. Now this is the machloket. So now, if you say everybody holds of Rabba bar Rav Huna, according to the Bali Tosfos, there may be no Gershon, that means nobody thinks there's Lashon Hara over here. According to the Rashbam, that means that everybody thinks in order to get information publicly disseminated, you need three people. So, this is the machlokes. The one who says that you need two says that a mecha, not face-to-face, doesn't work. So then, what's the point of having two? That is idut to the fact that you were mocha bifanav. The two people, the requirement of two people is because you need edim to tell us that you actually did this face-to-face with him. The two edim are not about the dissemination of the information. They are your ra'ayah. They're your proof that you actually did it face to face. And therefore, using the gimel either removes the problem of lashon hara, according to Bayi Tosfot the Rabbeinu Gershom, according to Rashbam, it makes it into a public dissemination of information. That everybody agrees that an objection, not face to face, works. This is what they're arguing about. The one who says in front of two sover saaduta beinan. We need edut. We need public dissemination of the information. So the question is, how formal is this situation? It turns out to be actually counterintuitive. The more people you have, the less formal it is. Which is that if you require two, it means that you require edut. We need testimony to your micha'a. That would mean two things. One is that you only need two. And number two is that those two have to be kosher edim. On the other hand, if you're just requiring a giloi milta, you just want it to become publicly known or publicly disseminated, then we won't require edut, but we will require a larger number of people, but those people don't have to be kosher the edut. It could be your relatives that you're speaking to, because the only thing we're interested in is that public dissemination of the information, not necessarily the edut, the testimony to the fact that you objected in that manner. Might actually relate back to something that we saw at the beginning of the sugya, and that is, why is there a waiting of 3 years? What is this idea of a chazakah of 3 years? And what is the idea of the objection due? So we had a machloket in the Rishonim as to how to express this. The way that we've been expressing it all along is the way that the majority of Rishonim express it. It's the view of the Bali HaTosafot, the Rashbam, and many others, that the 3 years has to do with people normally keep their shtar for 3 years. And after that point in time, they start to lose track of the shtar. They don't keep it around. And therefore, we give them the benefit of the doubt at that point that they lost the shtar, as long as they come with a proper claim. The objection that is raised by the other party is a warning to keep the shtar, to say you don't get rid of the shtar, because if you get rid of the shtar, you're not going to have proof anymore. And this objection says that we have questions about your ownership of the property, and without a shtar, we're not going to give you the property. So that's the way we've been learning until now. There is a view that we mentioned back in the beginning of the perek, of the Ramban, which is that this is actually a much more fundamental issue. According to the Bali Tosfot, the Rashbam, the way we just expressed it, this is a takana de Rabbanan. It's an institution of the Rabbanan to protect buyers, that they don't have to keep their contracts forever or their bill of sale forever. And the institution of the Chachamim was balanced between the buyer and the seller, and that balance was, we don't make you keep it more than 3 years, but we give the right to the person who wants to object and then force you to keep the shtar for a longer period of time. On the other hand, the Ramban said it was a much more fundamental issue, which is that a person who's on the property, in order to declare him the owner or the mukzak in the property, he should have to show a shtar. If he doesn't show a shtar, then actually he should lose his rights over here, or the burden of proof should lay with him because he can't prove any ownership over here. He can't demonstrate ownership over here. So the lack of a shtar is actually a pgam or a weakness in your claim. And so therefore, when you don't show up with a shtar, you actually have a problem now because your lack of shtar hurts your case or detracts from your claim. What we say is that after 3 years, that no longer is a detraction from your claim because it's reasonable to assume that a person might have lost the shtar, or the lack of a shtar is no longer evidence of the fact that this person didn't purchase the land. So what the Ramban says is that's a fundamental idea in chazaka. Your chazaka in the first 3 years is weakened by the fact that you don't present the shtar, because we would expect you to have a shtar. Your lack of a shtar after 3 years is not a weakness, because then we no longer would expect you necessarily to have a shtar. What the mecha'ah does, the objection does, is weakens your position now without a shtar even beyond the 3 years. And basically says is, now your lack of a shtar remains a problem after the 3 years because someone objected to the ownership. Someone objects to the ownership, you better have a shtar to prove it, because now the burden of proof lies with you and your lack of a shtar will be a lack in your chazakah. So that's the way the Ramban expressed it. So the Ramban sees this 3 year period in the chazakah and the objection as being much more fundamental. Or in essence, it is a din that even could be d'oraita. It's a question of chazakah. It's a question of when the chazakah is established and what weakens or strengthens your chazakah. And then for the Balei Tosafot, the Rashbam and others, it's clearly an institution of the Chachamim in order to help out the buyer with some mitigating factors to protect the seller. Now, given that the Tosafot read back when that was expressed brought this machloket as a demonstration of maybe a nafkamina between the two reasons, which is that, according to those that believe that the primary reason for the Shlosh Shanim has to do with the fact that he keeps his shtar, doesn't keep his shtar, whether he's on warning or not, then over here, Gilui Milta will be the most important factor. The dissemination of the information or getting the information to that party is the most important factor. And therefore, we require three, or Gilui Milta, in order that he is on warning or noticed of the fact that he needs to keep his shtar. But the only way he's going to know that is if the information is disseminated or reaches him. And therefore we put a premium or primacy on the dissemination of information, or ensuring that the information reaches the person who's in the property now. And therefore we require three. On the other hand, the other view is, it has to do with whether you've established a chazakah or the strength of your claims. One of the claims that you have is that I've been here for a while and nobody objected. That strengthens your claim to the chazakah, and that's what allows you to not present the shtar, is because nobody objected. Since nobody objected, your chazakah, your claim, is stronger. Given that, the lack of shtar doesn't hurt your claim. On the other hand, if there's an objection in the interim period, then that other party has a strong claim against you, or in essence, he's weakened your chazakah. By weakening your chazakah, you'll need a shtar now to back up your chazakah. So it's just a reality. The reality is, was there an objection? Was there not an objection? The objection then shifts the burden of proof to you. And by doing so, shifting the burden of proof to you, the only way to overcome that is to present the shtar. On the other hand, if there was never an objection, then your chazakah can act to overcome the claims of the other party, and the burden of proof will be on the other party, because your lack of shtar is no longer an indication or of a weakness in your claim. And so, according to that opinion, a deem would suffice. As long as there was an objection made, whether it reached the other party or not, doesn't matter. The objection me now strengthens the claim of the original owner. And in strengthening his claim, now your counterclaim must be stronger. The only way for your counterclaim to be stronger is if you have a shtar. You don't have a shtar, your counterclaim will not be as strong. And you will fail, and then the burden of proof will lay with you. All you need the edim for is to determine who has the stronger claim here, or who has the burden of proof over here. In that case, edim would suffice. It's not all about dissemination of information. It's simply about whether there is an objection or not an objection. If there's no objection, then the burden of proof shifts to the original owner, because the party that's been in the property without an objection now has a claim to this property, and you will have to undermine that claim. And his lack of a shtar is not a big deal. On the other hand, if there was an objection, then your claim is much stronger. Now his chazakah is not meaningful, and the only claim that he's going to have that's going to work is the fact that he has a shtar. His lack of shtar in the face of your objection will be a weaker claim. And so therefore, for those parties, it's the edim that make the difference, and that's why you need edut and not gilui milta. So the Tosfot read over here speculates that this machloka between saduta and gilui milta is actually a more fundamental machloka as to how chazakah functions. Or why is this 3-year period, whether you need the contract or not contract, what's the reason behind that? It goes back to this machloka between the Ramban and the Baalei Tosafot and others, when we were discussing the 3 years of a chazakah and the necessity to keep the shtar for 3 years and not beyond the 3-year period. You can see in the Rashbam that he clearly disagrees with that view of the Tosafot read, and thinks that the machloka here is the quality of dissemination of information that you need. And he says that when you have it by Edim, if you tell it over to Edim, that's enough. Even though that's not a public dissemination of the information, it's enough that you got it into the hands of parties that will possibly or could convey the information. Whereas a person who requires gilui milta requires that you have an anansade almost, that we have the dissemination of the information almost as a given. Because you've told it to enough parties who will disseminate the information. So their machloket is, what is the threshold of dissemination that we require? Is it that we require it that you disseminate it in a manner that almost will guarantee it reaches the other party? Or is it enough that you put it in potential? You give it to 2 people and then potentially it'll reach him. Whether it does or doesn't isn't as important. Just the point that you put it into play, that's enough. And that's the question between them. And so the real question is, do we need the party who is muksak in the property to hear it? According to the one who says gilui milta, the answer is yes. Because once you put it into the public domain, we assume he's going to hear it. And that is the necessity over here, is that the information reach him. On the other hand, by the two edim, it just has to be in potential it could reach him. Whether it does or does not reach him isn't as important. It's whether you gave the possibility or you created a circumstance in which it could reach him. That's enough in terms of your obligation to object. If it reaches him, good. If it doesn't reach him, fine. It's his problem. It's his loss. But this is for the protection of the seller. Again, this is one of the mitigating rights that the Chazal gave to the seller, that his objection in front of two would suffice, even though there's no guarantee that it will reach the ears of the buyer. Now the Gemara continues. Gido bar mnume avalei mechuya limchuye. He had to make an objection. He had somebody in his property illegally, and now he needs to object in order to remove them from his property. He bumped into these 3 Amoraim, Davi Yatve. They were sitting together. And he objected in front of them. The Rashbam over here says that it was just circumstance. This is not a proof or an answer to the question we had before as to whether you need 2 or 3 in order to have a mecha'ah. This is simply was the situation or circumstance. He happened to bump into the 3 of them together, and therefore he presented his mecha'ah in front of them. But not that he wouldn't have done it if there were 2. So the Rashbam says this has nothing to do with the previous question about 2 or 3. It has to do with, well, we'll see in a second, how mecha'ah works. But there's no requirement based on this to do it in front of 3, although you could have read it, that the Gemara is bringing it in this context to show you that he did a mecha'ah in front of 3, and there would be an absolute necessity to do it in front of 3. And then the story continues and says, the shana hadar atalim chuye. The next year he showed up again and objected again to these same individuals. Amrulei lo tzarich. He said, you don't have to do this. You objected already last year. You don't have to come back and object again this year. Hachi amar Rav, because this is what we have in the name of Rav. After you already objected on the first year, you don't have to object anymore. And some say, that Chir Barav said this. It was his own statement, not in the name of his father, Rav. That once you've objected in the first year, you do not have to object in the subsequent years. So now the Gemara continues. Amar Reish Lakish Mishum Bar Kapara. So now we have a statement from Bar Kapara, "B'tzarich limchot b'sof kol gimel v'gimel." He has to object every 3 years. So now you could have read this statement of Reish Lakish Amar Bar Kapara as arguing on the previous statement of Rav, which is Rav says you object once and that's sufficient for the rest of your life. Once you've objected once, there's no way to establish a chazaka anymore, And no matter how much time elapses from that point in time. The other in Bar Kapara says every 3 years you need to reestablish your objection because of what might happen in the interim. What is the problem in the interim? So if you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says, the problem is Yochol HaMachzik Lomar Achrei Shemachita Mechartali, that after you objected, you sold it to me. So you can say, yes, you objected in the first place. Now that you objected in the first place, you're right, it wasn't my property. But after that, I've been there for 3 years without any objection. So what you can say is, you sold it to me. After you objected in the first place, I came and paid you for the property, and now I bought it. And now I've been here for 3 years without any objection. So now I can take possession of the property. That requires me then to object every 3 years in order to prevent something like that happening. The Rashbam, on the other hand, quotes that and dismisses it out of hand and says that's not possible. And that is because the original way that you came onto this property was illegal. Which says that you came onto the property, claimed it was yours, and then the person came and objected to your ownership. That means that your entrance into the property was like a gazlan or illegal. After that, you can't make a claim that I bought it from him. You will not be believed. We will not, whether it's trust you, or you cannot establish a chazakah after the chazakah that you started with was undermined. And therefore, he dismisses this view of the Rabbeinu Gershom and others, that the problem here is that he might come back and claim that he bought it after the fact. But rather, the Baal HaTosafot to help us understand what the Rashbam says in rejecting the view of the Rabbeinu Gershom. The problem is that he might say, I thought that you changed your mind, or I thought you retracted your objection. If you indicate an objection, and then we don't hear from you forever, the person assumes that that objection was either made mistakenly, or you've forgiven or you let it go now, and you're not enforcing that objection. So why you have to object over and over again is to say that your objection is still in force. And that's why you need to repeat it every 3 years. Now, what the Rashbam then also says is that Rav and Bar Kapara are not arguing. He says that when Rav says that you have to object once, he didn't mean once and then never again. He just meant once every 3 year cycle. That's what you have to do. And Bar Kapara is saying the same thing, meaning that Bar Kapara and Rav are not arguing. Bar Kapara is just indicating that what does it mean they have to object once? It means once in every 3 year cycle, or you have to at least have an objection within every 3 year period. And Rav doesn't disagree with that. Again, the simplest way to read the Gemara is that this statement of Bar Kapara argues on that which Rav said before. The way that Rashbam and many Rishonim believe is that that's not the case, and that Bar Kapara is just expanding on Rav's original position, which is Rav says you don't have to, in the first 3 years, object more than once. And then Bar Kapara says, well, over a larger period of time, you have to object every 3 year period. And therefore, he's just enhancing the statement of Rav, or adding to the statement of Rav, not arguing on that statement of Rav. And the Tosafot brings support for that view in the Rashbam, because it says that when it says over here that Reish Lakish brings the statement in Bar Kapara, it should have said Reish Lakish Amar. When you have two opinions and they're arguing, you bring the first opinion, and then the second one begins Reish Lakish Amar. But the next member starts Amar Reish Lakish Amar Bar Kapara. That makes it into an independent statement, or it makes it clear that it's not arguing on the previous statement. And so that's supportive of this view of the Rashbam, that this statement of Reish Lakish does not argue on a Rav, or that Rav doesn't believe you don't have to object forever. It just means that you only have to object once in every 3 year cycle. V'toyva Rabbi Yochanan. Yochanan was perplexed by this statement of Bar Kapara. V'hi gazlan yesh lo chazaka? Since when does a gazlan, a thief, have a chazaka? Over here, this person objected to him being there. It says that he's a thief stealing the land. If you're stealing land, how do you establish a chazaka? The Gemara says, gazlan sakadatcha? Since when is he a thief? He only claimed, the objector claims he's a thief. We have no proof that he's a thief. Hello, kid gazlan, yesh lo chazaka? Rabbi Yochanan says, I don't understand. If someone is questioning your authority to be there, then how can you establish a chazaka? Your claim is questionable. It's one thing to establish a chazaka when there's nobody blocking your claim or denying your claim. But if someone is denying your claim, then how can you establish a chazaka in a claim that is shrouded in doubt? Now, once again here, the Rashbam says that Rabbi Yochanan does not disagree with Bar Kapara. He raised the question, but not raising the question to the point that he believes that Bar Kapara is wrong. He simply raised an issue, and even though the issue is a real issue, nevertheless, he does not deny or disagree with that position of Bar Kapara. Given that, it's pretty clear that the Rashbam believes that we paskin like Bar Kapara. Because he made Rav not argue on Bar Kapara and Rabbi Yochanan not argue on Bar Kapara. That means that everybody agrees to this position of Bar Kapara. And therefore the Halacha would be like Bar Kapara. So even though the Balei Tosfot agree, actually help us understand what the Rashbam says in rejecting the view of the Rabbeinu Gershom, that the problem here is not that he bought the property after the Ta'anah, but rather the reason is a person only keeps his shtar around for 3 years, and if 3 years elapse without any objection, he's going to say, I thought you didn't have the objection anymore, and I didn't keep my shtar anymore. So he's the one who explained that that's the reasoning behind the Rashbam, but he disagrees with the conclusion of the Rashbam. The Balei Tosafot over here suggests that this statement of Bar Kapara argues on a Gemara earlier. Back on Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, it says that once you make one Micha'ah, or you indicate that the person has to keep the shtar, that is sufficient. And in that case, it would seem that Rav would argue on Bar Kapara, maybe Rabbi Yochanan as well. And the Shita of the Gemara from before is arguing on this position of Bar Kapara. And he says, unlike the Rabbeinu Chanana, who paskins like Bar Kapara, and the Rashbam, who seems to lean in that way also, the Balei Tosafot think that the Halacha is like the other view, that you only have to object once, and that's sufficient. You don't have to object every 3 years. All right, now, just to finish off, Tani Bar Kapara, we have another din for Bar Kapara. Chazar v'ir er. If a person objects, then comes back and objects again, and then come back and objects again. Imach matana rishona ir er. If he, every time he objects, comes with the same reasoning as to why he's objecting, ein lo chazaka. You don't establish a chazaka, even though it wasn't necessary for him to come in and object every year. Or some requests say over here that it's talking about over a 9-year period. He's objecting once in every one of those 3-year periods. There it is necessary, according to Bar Kapara, to object in each of those cases. Or in a case where it's 3 years, even though it wasn't necessary, he objected every year. As long as he's consistent in his claim, then he blocks the other party from establishing a chazaka. V'imlav, if he's inconsistent in his claim, yesh lo chazaka. Then you can establish a chazaka, because as the Rashbam points out over here, that if he changes an objection, then basically what he's saying is that what I said before, or why I objected to your ownership here before, was a lie, or was incorrect. So he himself is undermining his original objection. And therefore we're not going to believe him about his original objection, but once he's himself has cast aspersions on his first objection, we're also going to question his second objection. His lack of consistency makes us question the veracity of his statements. And therefore his micha'ah no longer becomes a micha'ah because of the internal contradiction in the objections that he is raising. Now, it's probably true that that's only the case where his objections are mutually exclusive. Meaning that if they are reconcilable, the two different objections, then I don't think we would say that that ruins his block of the chazaka. It's only in a case where he makes objections that clearly are differentiated in a manner that makes one true and the other one not true, then we would say that he's reversing his opinion or changing his mind. That changing of his opinion undermines his credibility with regards to this claim. And therefore the party can say, I didn't believe you had a real objection. Or, I can establish a chazaka because your objection is not really an objection. So where the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Rashbam read it over here is simply your changing of your mind on the second year is what undermines your credibility. On the other hand, the Meiri over here suggests that you need to object all 3 years, since it was only necessary for you to object once, and instead you objected 3 times, and in those 3 times you came up with 3 different reasons for objecting, that's what undermines your credibility, which is that you're giving a different reason each time and in a position where it's not necessary. You didn't need to object each of the years, you only needed to object once. And here where you changed your mind twice, that already undermines your credibility. And given the Girsa in our Gemara, it seems supportive of that view that it's 3 times before you lose your credibility, versus the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Rashbam read that it's only 2 times that you need to undermine your credibility. Okay, we're going to stop here on the last line of Lamed Tet Amud Bet.